I wish that I could harness the amount of time you will think about the calories in a banana. I wish we could harness that, because if we could, we'd found a cure for cancer.
How did we become so far removed from reality? Because I'm sure 100 years ago, if a woman was a couple of kilos over, she wouldn't have berated herself.
Exactly.
It wouldn't have consumed her mind how we did. And for me, I think social media and the phones are the antichrist. I wonder what it would be like if we had a warning on social media. Warning, if you log in, you're likely to lose the next hour of your day, feel less good about yourself.
If I created a product and said, I've got this product, everyone's going to love it. In fact, you're actually going to get addicted to it. And by the way, you're going to increase your risk of anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts. Is that a good idea? Everyone will go, are you mad? That should be banned. There's no good food. There's no bad food. That doesn't exist. That is a construct.
See, I disagree here, yeah? Hi, guys, and welcome back to Getting There, the podcast. Today, we are joined by one of the most outspoken voices in British medicine, Dr. Max Pemberton. Max isn't just an NHS doctor, he's a journalist and someone who has been analysing human behaviour long before the rest of us started questioning what on earth is happening to society. At 23 years of age, he wrote an unsolicited letter to the Daily Telegraph with three sample columns, and they hired him on the spot. With no distractions, just clarity, discipline and focus, traits that feel almost extinct today. And that's exactly what we're diving into. Why we can no longer think, why we can no longer focus, why we no longer know who we are without a screen in front of us. We talk about the attention crisis sweeping every generation. We sat down and talk about weight loss drugs, what they mean, and how they are being abused. We also spoke about the topic shaking the health world, Ozempic, weight loss culture, and the mental health fallout of medicating our way out of every uncomfortable feeling. What is this doing with our relationship with food, body image, identity, and resilience? This conversation cuts through the noise, cuts through the labels, and asks the one question that matters. What is happening to our minds? And is there still time to pull ourselves back? This is a conversation you will not want to miss. Hello, Max, and welcome to Getting There, the podcast. How are you?
I'm really well. Yeah.
I'm so excited to have you on. I know we've been having a bit of a conversation off air. So, guys, I'm going to bring you up to speed. Max sat down. We've not come up for air. But strangely, one of the things that we just started talking about was you have a new book coming out. You asked me to guess what it was, and I did.
I'm quite annoyed that I'm that predictable.
No, you're not. Because before Max came on, guys, I thought I wanted to talk to you about one thing, and like therapy culture. And as a society, have we gone too far? And even for me, who someone was in therapy for 5 years, are we wrapped in cotton wool? And then I went into your work and all of the issues we face as a society that you talk about from an unbiased point of view. And no one's really talking about the fact that most people are on weight loss drugs, and especially influencers and people in the health and wellness space. And when I studied your work, I came to understand that you actually worked at a
eating disorder
clinic. So one of the things I wanted to talk to you about with the access to these drugs, is this not exacerbating any kind of, well, number one, like a mental illness? Because I imagine eating disorder
absolutely
is a mental illness. But not only that, as in terms of body dysmorphia, because I have a lot of friends and people who have tried these weight loss drugs and who are on them. And I also think social media comes into play here, Max, because we think everyone looks like their social media page. Like, I can't tell you how many times I've sat on the beach and thought, where are the abs? Like, no one actually fucking looks like that on the beach. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. But we've got this false sense of illusion of what we must look like.
Absolutely.
And I think that's fueling us, when I even say it out loud, like fueling us to inject ourselves to look better. But let's get into it. Tell us about the book.
I would say, so this is the issue, and this is what makes me upset about this, in that I think that these drugs, for decades, doctors have been really worried about obesity and have been, essentially we have very little to offer patients, really. We just said, you need to eat less and move more, and that's pretty much it. And we know for the vast majority of people that just for complicated reasons, that just doesn't work. So we've had this rising absolute obesity epidemic that's killing people and causing people profound disability. And it's costing the economy, it's costing people emotionally and psychologically and physically, it's dreadful. And actually, we've been relatively impotent. We've been powerless to do much about it. And these drugs have come along, and I think they are revolutionary, and there's so much potential in them for treating obesity. But inevitably what ends up happening with these things is a whole lot of other people want to use them that actually they're not licensed for. So they're not approved for people who have a BMI below 30 or BMI 27 plus an obesity related illness. And instead they're being used not as a treatment for a medical illness or condition, but they're being used for aesthetics. And this is the issue I would have with it, is that they are not intended and shouldn't be used because you want to drop a dress size or you want to go, wear a bikini on the beach. That's not what they're for. They are, and I feel like the sad thing is that they've been tarred with that brush as like, it's for kind of slightly narcissistic people, people who are just a bit like obsessed with their image. Exactly, a vain, exactly. And actually, they offer real hope for people that have struggled with obesity. So I think they're one tool, though. So even within that group of people that I think need them and warrant them and they're useful for, they are only one tool in the kit bag that you need to tackle obesity. Because really, we focus on what people are eating. But the way I think about it is, actually what's happening is you're playing out what's going on in your mind on your plate. So the vast majority of people who are overweight or obese and are struggling with their weight have underlying psychological issues.
So it's taking it back to what you said there. You said, like, as doctors and in the NHS, you felt pretty powerless up until this stage. Now, do you think that's because you saw it as a physical illness rather than a mental illness and we weren't looking at what was going on in the mind?
Well, exactly. So I would say, working in eating disorders, so I used to run a clinic for severely obese people, and I mean really very, very profoundly obese people who were about to have surgery. And I always, I trained as a psychiatrist, I trained in physical medicine, but also in mental health. And a lot of my colleagues would sit there thinking, well, actually, we're treating the physical issue here by surgery. But really, once you get down to it, you realise that there's a lot of emotional issues going on here. And nobody is doing that. And interestingly, I was just writing this in the book, in the beginning, opening bit of the book, the relapse rates of for post-bariatric surgery. So you have your stomach literally partially removed.
Yeah.
And yet people still override that and put the weight back on.
I had a friend who had a gastric band surgery. Yep. And she worked out that if she laid down, she could bypass it and get cheese down.
Exactly. Exactly. So this is this. In the clinic I used to work in, we used to have a post-bariatric surgery complications clinic where people coming in, and I remember one woman, she realized, because she hadn't done the psychological work, not her fault, it's because it wasn't really offered in a profound way. There's a bit of psychotherapy offered at the beginning to prepare you, but it was nothing that was actually to the level that was needed. And she worked out that she could eat cheese puffs, basically like Wotsits. She was eating because she wanted the sensation in her mouth of it being full, because she associated that with a whole lot of other things emotionally. So she ended up eating around 100 bags of Wotsits a day.
Because
they're like puffy. Yeah. Obviously, it meant that she could get the volume in her mouth, but actually in her stomach, it didn't feel like it didn't push out her stomach so much because she had physically less stomach. But it meant that she was so deficient, her nails and hair started falling out. So she came to our clinic to say, I have some sort of eating disorder. And I was like, well, actually, you have disordered eating. You have an unhelpful relationship with food. It's not your fault because of what happened to you as a child. But you use food as a coping mechanism, and now we've taken that away because we've literally cut your stomach.
Yeah.
And your mind still needs a coping mechanism. So if we take away that coping mechanism, it will do everything it can. And I often think of it, it's like someone's being shipwrecked and they're flailing around, drowning in the ocean, and there's this storm all around them, and that's their kind of emotional storm they're in. They will grab onto absolutely anything they can that floats past to stop themselves from drowning. Now, that might be eating 100 bags of Wotsits. It might be drugs and alcohol, because we know that the rates of drugs and alcohol increase by a third after bariatric surgery. And I feel like this is the problem. Going back to the injections, this is the problem with the injections, is that if you don't do the psychological work that is necessary to understand why you use food as a coping mechanism in the first place, during that break from the food noise that these injections give you what we call symptom interruption. If you just take the medications and keep going and think, well, this is fantastic, I'm just eating less, you're not addressing the emotional issues that were that drove the obesity in the first place. And that means you are either, when you stop, you'll put the weight back on, or you're going to be on these forever. Now, as a doctor, I don't want people to be on a medication they don't need to be on forever. And certainly what I don't want is people to then just stop it, put the weight back on because they haven't addressed the underlying issues, and then they just use it as a failed diet. It's another yo-yo diet. That's all they're doing. And to me, that's a tragedy because it's a missed opportunity to change how you feel, your kind of emotional coping mechanisms and so on.
I feel like as a society, for most women, particularly my age and older, and younger, like actually most women, I would actually say have some form of disordered eating where we have been influenced. I mean, I don't know if you remember the Special K advert. Eat Special K for 2 weeks and you will then finally...
I mean, it's insane. No, but... I mean, you can't believe it.
So this is what I'm saying. We're talking about one group of people that are here, like,
yeah, and have a shake for breakfast, one for lunch and then a proper meal. I'm like, what?
Slim Fast.
Eat normal food.
But we've become... so far away from what our gut is and what real food looks like. So
absolutely.
I feel like we're talking about these people that are clinically obese, yes. And that is one thing that comes to your clinic. But for the general public who are having little Greggs for breakfast, you know, not eating great, but it's what we've been conditioned to think's food. They think getting a sandwich out of Sainsbury's is a healthy food choice and a bag, like, you know, we were conditioned to think a bag of crisps, a sandwich and a chocolate bar for lunch. Like, how many times have you seen the meal? And I think I would be speaking for most women. We all have this type of body dysmorphia and we've had this influence on our lives that has made us feel that we need to live up to this idea of perfection. And I think it's been exacerbated by social media and everyone using it. So my concern with the weight loss stuff is, great, it's the same as the gastric stuff. Go and give it to these people that are in chronic condition.
Yes.
But it's the abuse of us that sit in the middle, that are vain.
And I would say it's understandable. You're completely right. I mean, I saw this played out multiple times every single day with people where it had gone to the extreme and they had got their disordered eating and body dysmorphia had morphed into an eating disorder. But before people got to that stage, we'd often get referred cases that didn't meet the threshold really for our service because we were a very specialist service. But and I would be heartbroken. And you'd hear these really beautiful, amazing women. And the majority were women. We did sometimes have men, but the majority women who had a really chaotic, dreadful relationship with food and their body through no fault of their own, through the conditioning that happens in society. But my concern is those people now think the answer, therefore, is to take these injections. And actually, that's not the answer. The answer is to change our relationship with our body and food. And I'm a great advocate. I spend my life telling people regular eating is a key thing. Don't ever skip meals. That's not healthy. That's not how regular, normal people have a relationship with food. Food, there's no good food. There's no bad food. That doesn't exist. That is a construct.
See, I disagree here, yeah? Because...
what's bad food? Nate, give me a bad food.
Ice cream.
Why is that bad?
Because it's processed.
The
so
quantity
for me...
is bad. But you can have anything. If you have a scoop a month, why is that bad?
No, it's not. But it's no...
So it's not bad food? It's no, our relationship and the way we eat it that's bad.
I have a rule. If you can pronounce it, you can eat it. So my son is allowed, like... people who've been following me for a while know I had to work on my son's health for a lot, literally about 2 years max. So I have to do damage control because he goes to his dad and his dad has a terrible diet. But I also am very conscious that I don't want him to have then a bad relationship with food because also I was 11 stone when I was 11. So I want to give you some context. So to me, I still have that really overweight girl in me that, and sometimes she'll rear her ugly head and I still think I'm her. And I don't want to put my eating habits onto my son. But as a rule of thumb, we have a rule that if you can pronounce it, you can eat it. Mm-hmm. So if I see the back of a Kit Kat bar, I can't name half of those things. Whereas my son can go and have a bit of Hugh, or if I make a cake at home, he's more than welcome to have it. But I would say if you can't pronounce what's in your food, that is a bad food because it's not a food.
But I would say we need to move away from the idea of good and bad because it's very pejorative. There's a judgment there, and then when somebody eats a bad food, they become a bad person. what I would say, it's not about the food that is good or bad. All food is just units of calories. That's all it is, really.
But isn't there nutritional value? So I would say that a banana is better than a Kit Kat.
But only better depending on how often you're eating it. There's no reason why you can't have a Kit Kat once a month or once a week, providing you're also eating nuts and fruits and lean meat and so on and so on. But it's fine. But I think what's happened, this is part of the process that we put foods into good and bad. It's not a food inherently is not good or bad. It's just calories combined. What is good and bad is the quantities and the way that our relationship with that food. So if you're eating too much ice cream, or you're not having fruit because you're having ice cream, that is unhelpful and an unhealthy relationship with food. It's not the food that's the problem, it's our relationship with it. And that is, it's a very strong kind of message that we have within eating disorders, that we try and move away from the moralizing of food into good or bad categories. I mean, I spend my life saying to people, eat more fruit and vegetables, eat lean meat, you know, all these kind of things. But we need to be careful. And you're right. And I do understand that there are certain things like ultra processed foods. The issue I have with those is that they are engineered specifically to make them very addictive. And that is what becomes difficult about it. But in itself, inherently, an ultra processed food is not particularly bad. It's not going to kill you. It's fine to have, but it's in moderation. And that's the thing I think we need to be moving towards.
But knowing that it's engineered to make you want more. So I just want to give an example. I don't see these like strawberry bear things that they do for the kids, and all over it's like 100% strawberries, blah, blah, blah.
I know exactly.
And like, bless my son's grandparents. Yeah, like they're so cute. They're so old. They're like, oh, he's just 100% strawberries. I honestly want to kick them up the bum every time they give him one. But we've been programmed to believe, oh yeah, it's just fruit. But the problem is, if I give him that, he's not going to be satisfied with that, because like you say, it's been engineered for him to want more. Therefore, with that, with an understanding, and if I were to, maybe it's for me, I like things in black and white. If I was going to create an eating plan as such, or to better my eating, I would want to create something where I could understand what I should be having more of and what I should be having less of, good and bad.
Yeah, but that's okay. But let's move away again from the good and bad idea.
But more is that not helpful? But I'm
well,
one of these.
But I would say this is part of the problem, because this what we, I mean, you said it yourself, black and white thinking.
Yeah.
So we know that people who've struggled with food often find it very easy. And we used to say this to lots of our patients with anorexia. At the beginning bit of their recovery, and often for quite some time in their recovery, we would give them food cheats of like, okay, so you need to have a banana for breakfast and do this and this, because their relationship with food was so chaotic and so disordered and so troublesome to them that actually they weren't able to think rationally about it, and they needed to eat off a sheet. But we used to say to them, ultimately, people without an eating disorder don't need to eat off a sheet. They eat off a plate. And this is part of the problem, is that I understand that people who've had a troublesome relationship with food, sometimes having this black and white thinking is easy because it helps them navigate. But ultimately, that narrative in society around this, you know, clean eating suggests that there's also dirty food. No food is dirty.
Okay.
Food is just food. And, you know, I sometimes have a Kit Kat, sometimes I don't. I've never had, and I don't have any issues with food particularly. So I can't see things in good or bad. I do understand, though, that some people who've struggled with food, it's helpful for them.
Yeah, like for me, automatically, I think, but I'm a very black and white person. So yeah. I'm like, I get that. Sometimes I feel like I need to have a boundary around things to get an understanding.
But then when you break the boundary, what happens and how do you feel?
You binge. Like, I used to binge. I used to hate myself.
But this is the point, isn't it? So this is part of what feeds these unhelpful behaviours, this idea of like, well, now I've been a bad person. I've transgressed. I've moved from something good into something bad. Therefore, you know, I've sinned. I need to punish myself, or screw it.
I would now, be like, now I just keep going. If I like then had one biscuit, I'd be like, I've already cheated. I might
exactly.
Eat the whole bag.
So you give yourself permission because it's bad. And you're like, well, now I've ruined everything. And actually that's underlying part of that disordered eating, and that's why eating disorder specialists tend to be so strongly opposed to the idea of clean eating, good food and bad food and so on. I totally understand it helps structure the world, and we all want to structure the world in one way or another, because the world is chaotic and a bit mad. But ultimately, fundamentally, as a society, I want us to move away from that idea. And my concern is, I think these medications offer great hope to people who genuinely struggle, because it gives them a break to do that work, whereas I feel like nobody is saying to people who just feel a bit rubbish about their body, even though their body is amazing and fantastic and they look beautiful, you maybe need to go off and speak to somebody and address why you feel this, because there's actually nothing wrong with your body. Or the idea that I'm a BMI of, you know, slightly overweight. So I'm going to, rather than think about what changes I can make to my diet, my lifestyle and so on, I'm going to take an injection instead. That to me seems the tragedy.
And how did we become so far removed from reality? Because I'm sure 100 years ago, if a woman was a couple of kilos over, she wouldn't have berated herself.
Exactly.
It wouldn't have consumed her mind how we did.
Exactly.
And for me, I think social media and the phones are the Antichrist. And no, genuinely.
I honestly completely agree with you.
I sing it from the rooftops, yeah? Yeah. And to the point, like, my boyfriend's like, people don't care. I was like, I care and I won't stop talking about it.
I'm telling you, I think phones should be banned until you're 18.
100%.
I'm
like,
no. No kid needs a mobile phone.
Dr. Sanjeev on here that was I'll talk to you about him after, but he's got an OBE for all the work he's done, yeah. But we're going to go into this after because I know you did a book on addiction, and obviously they're rewiring our children's brains as well. But I wonder if this has been this advertising and the programming has been the point where it's come to that we've let it weigh so heavy on our minds. And I often think as a woman, if we could free up that space from what we look like to go out and create and do amazing things, how much better would the world
be? I used to say to all my patients, I was like, do you know what? I wish, because you with the eating disorders, one of the things I loved about doing it is that you work with the people for years sometimes. You know them, like I still know some of my patients' mobile phone numbers. I know them, you know them so well. They've got your email address. You have a really intense relationship with them. So you can kind of be quite honest with them. And I used to say repeatedly, I was like, I really wish in my clinic, all my patients, I wish that I could harness the amount of time you all think about the calories in a banana.
Yeah.
I wish we could harness that, because if we could, we'd found a cure for cancer.
100%.
The amount of mental energy, and these are often really bright people, they're really smart. And I just think, God, the energy you expend on counting your calories, on trying to get your BMI slightly low, on losing weight, of obsessing over your thigh gap, all this stuff. You're such a brilliant, bright person. You could do so much incredible things with your life. And yet instead, it's just been wasted on worrying about
nothing. How much of that
nothing.
Do you think that is because of the advertising and social media and the influence in our lives?
Well, I think,
and sorry, before you say anything, do you ever recommend then to your patients, if they're suffering with some kind of body dysmorphia or comparison, to spend less time online?
I advise that they get a brick phone and stop and delete their Instagram account. Absolutely.
See, it's the first time.
I mean, what's really interesting is, so they have done studies in this. I mean, the thing that's useful, why I love science, is because you have an idea and you think, let's do a study about it, and you do a study, and then you can find if your idea was right or not. And they did an amazing study where in Fiji, do you know about? Have you heard about the studies they
went
did in
to Fiji?
Fiji?
No, not heard about the study.
So Fiji didn't used to have televisions.
Yeah.
And so a group of researchers went out and they managed to find this society that didn't have access to Western media. This is back in the 70s, I think it was done. Someone will correct me, but I think it was in the 70s. And they found there was no evidence of any eating disorders. They went back 20 years later where American television had come, and it had the same rate of eating disorders as the Western world. So, I mean, there's a really good evidence of like, oh, so there is something that's happening within the media.
Yeah.
And at that time, it was just TV. That is somehow making people feel not good enough, making people feel being introspective and looking at themselves and their body and so on. There's clearly something. Now, this was 30, 40 years ago. And since then, we're not worried now about TV shows. It's the constant bombardment of idealized body image. And also that conflict between like hidden food porn in your feed about like lovely gooey chocolate cake and so on, you know, you're worth it, et cetera, et cetera. And then we're going to juxtapose that with people with, for example, like, you know, thigh gaps or abs or so on and so on.
Love Island contestants.
Exactly.
Like they look like they've been
and do you know what? Absolutely outrageous.
Ken.
During the adverts, there was an advert. So I don't have a television, but my flat was being redecorated and they put me in because of a leak, and they put me in a hotel, a really swanky hotel in central London. And they had, and there was television. Now, so I'd never watched Love Island, didn't know anything about it. And I just went, I was just transfixed thinking, what on earth is this? And then it got to the break. And there was a break. During the break, there was an advert for cosmetic surgery for breast enlargement. And I was so furious because I sat there thinking, this is the embodiment of all our issues. We have these people who, you know, idealized bodies. They're kind of sat there and it's all done in a very sexualized environment. And then straight after in the break, there's an advert for cosmetic surgery. So I complained to the ASA and they pulled it. and it's been pulled, it's been banned. Because I was so furious. I was like, I spent my life trying to deal with this day in and out in a clinic. And eating and anorexia is the most deadliest psychiatric condition there is. It kills about 1 in 5 to 1 in 6 people with anorexia will die from anorexia. So I feel incredibly strongly about it. You know, I feel passionate about it. It's one of my dedicated part of my life to it. And I was just sitting there, just aghast, thinking, oh my God, what else? But the thing that set up in my mind was I just happened to have seen this randomly in a hotel room. What else is going on? You know, I'm not on social media. I'm not on Instagram. And then I was a few months after this, I was next to, I was at a very, very swanky dinner.
Go to swanky places, don't you?
Not always.
You
say, oh, I got invited.
Max is so swanky.
I'm swanky. Yeah. But it was it was in Notting Hill, in this townhouse in Notting Hill, all very nice.
Bougie.
Right, yeah. Very bougie. And there was a kid was sat next to me. She was 16. And her dad is quite a famous journalist and so on.
Are we dropping names?
No, we're not. Okay. No, because she was young at the time. She was a kid. And so I was sitting next to her and I was interested to talk to her. Because, you know, I don't often necessarily...
Mixed social kids.
Yeah, ooh. Exactly. It's a bit weird.
Teenagers.
And so I was talking to her and I told her what I did. And she was really eloquent and really lovely. And she sort of went a bit quiet. And she got out her phone and said, can I just ask, you know, as a doctor, is this normal? And honestly, it could, I genuinely makes me feel quite emotional. It could have broken my heart. And she picked up it. Now, I had never looked at Instagram, so I didn't know what
so
this
do
was.
Do you live under a rock?
Yes, basically. Okay. And so she scrolled up, and it was these images. Now, there's a thing, thigh gap. Do you know about thigh gap?
Yeah. I used to always want one.
So only about 5% of the population is physically possible, because it's to do with where your muscles enter into your pelvis. So, I mean, it's just an anatomical, they're anatomical freaks, people that have a thigh gap. But you used to hear a lot about this within eating disorders, people going, they used to use that as the thing of like, I know I'll be the right weight when I've got a thigh gap. They'll be emaciated.
It was a benchmark and you'll be like, to
exactly,
success
exactly,
in a bikini.
Exactly. And this young girl, 16, was just, and she was showing me her feed, and it was just full of people talking about their thigh gap. And I got a hand, and I was like, I want you to know now that is not normal. And I thought the fact this eloquent, articulate, you know, middle class girl with lots of access to things is asking someone at a party, can I just check, is this normal? And I was like, imagine all the other people who are not sitting next to an eating disorder specialist at a party, you know, who don't have all that privilege. Of course that's dripping into their heads. And then we wonder why people have eating disorders, have disordered these relationships with food and so on and so on, and feel miserable.
I feel like it's really interesting what you touched on there, but it was the marketing ploy as old as time, isn't it? Plant the seed, give the problem, give the solution. So what they've done is, you can look like her, the problem is you don't like her, and here's the solution. Like in literally full advertising, I think they forget that there's a lot of people that earn a lot of money on us feeling incredibly
low
absolutely. And bad about ourselves.
Of course. No, people who are happy don't spend money. It's only people who are miserable. Of course, 100%. But everyone who's miserable is looking for something, I would say. And, you know, the diet industry is a multi-billion pound industry. And they have, you know, their entire business model is built on making you feel a bit rubbish about yourself.
Yeah.
You know, everybody is, you know, indulgent foods, all sorts of things. The food industry, equally, if miserable people eat food.
So let's bring it back to, because I want to go into this social media. Because I feel like the two obviously coexist, but they're actually got the same kind of input into our lives. They affect us the same because we're being programmed and then we're being told this is the solution.
Absolutely.
So almost like what we were talking there with Love Island, you're a little bit overweight, but you can get this pen. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it does. But also what I worry about, and I know we spoke about this earlier, is for me as a society, we are forgetting what it is to be human. And when it takes hard work, grit, and determination. And by taking this pen, are we bypassing the lesson in life of what we need to do to become a healthier, fitter version of ourselves?
Well, so I think, you've touched on a really, really important point. I think the thing that I would encourage everybody to do, and I sort of feel desperate about, and part of this book is writing that I wrote is about this, is about moving away from this is not about aesthetics, and we need to really nip that in the bud. I mean, I get that maybe that horse has bolted, but I'm determined to emphasize this is not about aesthetics. It should be about how you feel, how healthy you are. You know, can you walk up the stairs without getting out of breath? Can you play with your grandchildren in the garden? That's what's really important in life, not about whether or not you've got abs on a beach. But then we get to the stage of like, okay, so assuming that we are focused on people who genuinely do need this or need, they need to lose weight. They are overweight and obese. Is the question then is that I think you're kind of asking is, well, actually, you know, is it not cheating in a way to use this medication? You know, because part of what being human is about kind of making change and so on. And that's an interesting idea, because what I would throw back at you is, if I'm a heroin addict, do you think it's reasonable that I get off heroin by using methadone? Or do if I smoke and I use nicotine replacement therapy patches, is that reasonable? Because actually most doctors would say, most people would say,
no, I would agree, that's reasonable.
That's okay. I would say these medications, this is the shift. It's not about being them on forever so you never have to do the work. It's about giving you the break from that mental constant chatter that's going on in people's head, like, shall I eat this? What, I want to eat this. I shouldn't eat that. It's bad, and so on. Calming that all down in order to do the psychological work. When it's exactly the way when I used to work in heroin addiction, in addiction services with my heroin addicts, you would say, we're going to put you on methadone in order so you don't have to keep on doing this, chasing the next bag of heroin and so on. So you can get stable. And in that time, you need to go and do psychotherapy. And we'd then provide psychology for them to do that work. And then we reduce the dose and then they get off and hopefully then they're free of the heroin.
But that's not happening.
Well, it should be. And that's why I've written the book.
Okay. But it's not though, is it? So talk me through the process.
Right, exactly.
Everyone I know can order it online. It comes the next day.
But don't forget, those people shouldn't, it sounds like from what you're saying, most of them aren't overweight and obese. They shouldn't be taking it anyway.
No, they look like me.
Yeah, so they shouldn't be taking it anyway. They're actually, whoever's prescribing it for them, it's prescribing it off license. That is not what it's licensed to use.
So how have they become so, here's my question.
Yes.
How have they become so accessible? And these big companies know that the amount they're selling is not serving the amount of people.
Well, that is a very good question.
So why are they not putting a boundary in place to protect us?
And legally, they should be. Absolutely legally, they should be. So I own and run a company that provides these for older people. So middle-aged to older people, because I think that's a particular market that's not being served very well and that we know really struggle for different changes that happen in their body, really struggling with weight loss anyway. So we know about 70% of people over the age of 60 are overweight or obese. And it's, there's a big burden of illness there. My company is incredibly strict. I mean, it's prohibitively strict. And I know that we can make a lot more money if we just went, okay, look, we're just going to ease this up a bit. You know, we have like multiple checks. We insist that people allow us to contact their GP. So we write to the GP and say, are you comfortable with us prescribing this? Do you think it's suitable? Could you weigh the patient? So, it's really, really boundaries. Now, that is what I think a lot of these companies should be doing. I think it's great that people can get it over the internet. It's brilliant. It's democratizing access to it. But it needs to be within the real strict confines of using these appropriate. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So, this was like another weight. What was it?
Liraglutide. It's another GLP-1. That's
all
that group of
medication.
All my mates
were on it like 4 or 5 before my son. So it would have been like over 5 years ago.
Because you had to inject it every day and that was the problem of it.
Okay. So all my mates were on it and someone was like, just ring this person, they'll give it to you. They were like, but don't tell her how thin you are. And I remember, guys, I'm just going to be honest.
Yeah.
So I was in my bed near where you lived in City Road. And I was like, if I put my shoulders up and if I go in and I'm FaceTiming her, she's like, how much do you weigh? I'm like, 16 stone. And she's like, but how tall are you? And I'm tall, right, Max? I'm 5'9", yeah? She's like, you still don't meet the criteria. I think you've got a mental health issue. I was like, you cheeky bastard. I rung all my mates. I was like, you've all got it. And all I've been told is that I've got a mental health issue. So I was like, someone give me another number. Like, I want to have a go at this thing.
Yes.
So I did eventually get hold of it. And I was in therapy at the time. I used to tell my therapist everything. And I was like,
good,
try
you're
this
supposed
thing.
To.
I know.
The idea.
Sometimes I'm like, oh, she doesn't need to know that bit. And she was like, but I injected it once and I just had a pure blown anxiety attack because I felt like I was overriding me. And there wasn't that much known about them then. But it was because I was in therapy. She was like, you don't need to medicate this. Your food issue isn't with food. We were working on like loads of childhood stuff. But only because I had those two things put in place. I was lucky enough to be in therapy. And at the time, it was policed to get the drug.
Yeah.
I wasn't able to use it. Now, I'm somebody who abuses stuff, yeah?
Yeah.
I used to take... Oh, my God. We're really going to personal fit. Is it Diathrone? They were like Speed.
Oh, yes. So for weight loss.
Babe. So I used to work at a...
How'd you get that? Oh.
I used to send fat people in there. Me and my friend.
What, those private clinics?
Yeah, private clinics.
Yeah, because people forget that used to happen.
And I think that made me really seriously ill. But this is how conditioned we were at the time. And at the time I was working in a bank and we were so tired and it was like taking
a
speed.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it is. It's a stimulant. That's how that works. I mean, it's how it works. It speeds up your metabolism. It speeds up everything.
But there are so many people in my life who have been through this whole kind of trying to fix ourselves through things. But yeah, it just... Interestingly, that stopped me from doing it, and my therapist did, and I really had to go in and introspect on myself rather than looking outside for a quick solution. But what concerns me is us middle ground people that have the accessibility to get this and why it's not being policed by the big pharmaceuticals.
Well, it's not the pharmaceuticals, it's the providers. The pharmaceuticals have policed it in that they've said this is the license, this is what you're allowed to give, who you're allowed to give this medication to. It's the people who are prescribing it and those companies who are often quite unscrupulous and are not doing it how they should. So it's the private companies and the pharmacies and so on, the online pharmacies, that some of them, not all of them, I'd say my one, I feel we're incredibly strict. Like, people are often irritated with us, with how strict we are. You know, we expect you to fulfill the criteria for which these medications were designed for, which I think is standard, but it's now weirdly seen as being strict. It's actually the standard we should all be at. But going back, because you mentioned, like, so what do people do? So I wrote this with a friend of mine who's also an eating disorder psychologist. She's a very dear friend. You should have her on because she's completely mad and brilliant.
I just thought that before you said that. Okay.
I love her. Courtney Raspin. She is mad as a box of frogs. She's brilliant. So much fun and so passionate and wonderful. And she speaks beautifully as well. Anyway, and so we wrote this book together. So half of it is about explaining how these drugs work and how they should be used appropriately. And the second half is a 12-session program for dealing with the psychological and emotional issues that resulted in someone being overweight in the first place. Because the argument is, take this medication for between 18 months and 24 months while you're doing the second part of the book, which is the psychological work that you need to address the underlying issue that resulted in your unhealthful relationship with food in the first place. And that is my concern, is that I think that is that step that isn't happening at the moment. People aren't, and even the NHS are prescribing this medication, they're not saying, and now you need to do psychological work to address the underlying issue. It is a symptom of something else. Obesity is a symptom of other problems. Mm. And we're treating, it's like being in pain and you give someone a painkiller and you never go, we should work out why you're in pain.
Yeah.
And maybe we need some other medication to deal with the underlying issue.
And what happens when people come off these?
Well, at the moment, I think that some people manage to do what we call have a cognitive shift. So some people do manage to, just while they have that mental break from this food noise and food chatter, they do manage to do some work on themselves. I would say those people are very, very much in the minority. We know the vast majority from the studies that have been done, we know the vast majority put weight back on.
Because they've abused it and not done it in the right way?
Because I think they've often done it too quickly. Because people, they think, oh, you know, how exciting, I'm going to lose loads of weight. And so they kind of rush. They lose lots of weight very quickly. The body has not got used to being that new weight. So, I mean, we can go into this if you want to for
a
second.
Please.
So there's a thing called set point theory.
Yes.
Do you know about this?
Yes.
Yeah. So set point theory, we in eating disorders, we try to call it settling point, because the set point is the idea that there's one number. So set point, to put it simply, is the idea that your body will naturally kind of sit at a particular weight. It's just the natural kind of thing.
My therapist used to say this to me, because every morning or every week I'd weigh myself and I'm pound up, pound down. And she was like, there'll be like 3 kilo difference, like whether you're menstruating or ovulating or whether
how much water you've had that day.
So you can't be like, oh my God, I've put on 2 pounds. So the set point, so for me, is roughly about 68 kilos, but I could go anything, to be honest with you, between 66 and 70.
So your settling point would be about, say, 66.
Yeah. But really,
about 68.
Anything over 70, I know I've probably put on a bit of weight. Yeah. But anything under that, I'm like, oh, I'm okay.
But what's interesting about settling point or set point is that it's genetically determined to some extent, pretty much. But actually, if you have emotional problems and you overeat because you're managing your emotions with food, for example, your set point, and you say your natural, inverted commas, set point is, say, a BMI of 23, say, for argument's sake. But actually, you spent most of your life at a BMI of 35. Your body starts to think that's normal, that's your set point.
Well, okay.
So when you suddenly start losing weight very dramatically, your body thinks, we've evolved from hunter-gatherers, your body thinks, oh goodness, we're going through a famine. Mm. We're now down to a BMI of 25 or 22, whatever. As soon as you stop and you go back to eating normally, your body will do absolutely everything it can to get you back to that set point.
The higher set point.
Which is 35, because that's where you've been for the majority of life. Now, the problem, so what we're seeing is that people are dramatically losing loads of weight over 6 months, say, getting to within healthy range, think, fantastic, I'm so happy, I've never been this weight before, I'm so great. They stop the medication, their body, without realizing it, they didn't realize this, but their body is thinking, oh, thank God, that famine was over. Whew,
yeah.
Quick, get a Greggs. Off you pop to Tesco Metro. And without realizing it, their body then puts them back up there. So, but what we know is that if you can maintain a set point, a lower weight, for between a year and 2 years.
That was going to be my next question. So you need
your
to keep...
set point or settling point will shift much nearer to genetically where you're kind of predisposed. Now, some people, and the warning about this is some people go, well, I want to be a BMI of 18. I want to be super skinny. But actually, if genetically you're just never going to be that,
yeah,
you will have to fight that because your settling point is still a BMI of 24.
Yeah.
And that's just naturally where your body is supposed to be, and we should celebrate that. And that's kind of where I feel about the body positivity movement. You know, I feel it's gone a bit warped because it's become all about, we've got to celebrate obese bodies, but actually what we should be celebrating is the variation, the normal healthy variation of bodies. And not everybody is going to be a supermodel with a BMI of, yeah, you know, 18
or
whatever.
Well, even like Victoria's Secret's model, they've done an interview, didn't they? They don't have water like that.
Well, exactly. Because actually, most of them are trying to, and I used, so in the eating, we're going off a bit here, but in my eating disorder clinic, I used to see a number of students who were at various ballet schools. And I ended up over the years, you end up doing career advice and career guidance.
I can imagine.
Them. Because what you had to say was, because they're told constantly, you're too big, you're too big, you're too big. Because they're a BMI of 24. And actually, they're eating perfectly healthy. They're doing lots of exercise. It's just where their body is supposed to be.
Mm.
But I'm like, really tragically, you've ended up in a profession with a very bizarre idea of what normal is. It is the end of the scale,
yeah,
of the skinny end of the scale. And so within that framework, you're seen as being too big. But actually, your body is perfectly fine. You're normal at this weight. This is good for you.
So most ballerinas have probably got an eating disorder.
No. Some will have. But some of them will just have naturally a BMI of 18.5 because that's the normal variation. So they sit at the very lowest end, just naturally. That's their settling point. So for them, and when you see somebody, if you interview a ballet dancer who is successful and so on, and they eat normally, they don't understand. Because they're just like, well, I just eat what I want. Because their body naturally just puts them at 18.5. The problem is, when your BMI is 24 and you're in an industry that says you've got to be 18.5, you're constantly fighting against your own settling point.
So what is the actual problem. Healthy so, parameters of BMI?
So sorry, I should have explained that. So it's 18.5 to 25.
Okay.
Now, BMI is not ideal. You know, it doesn't allow for mass, muscle mass and all sorts of things like that. Overall, though, generally speaking, most people, unless you're a rugby player or a bodybuilder or, you know, most people, it roughly fits within 18.5 to 25. There are some variations always. It's a normal distribution curve. So there's always some variation, but it's mostly within there. And it's important, I suppose, because these drugs are prescribed based on BMI.
Okay.
So that's why it becomes important. So normal is 18.5 to 25, and then obese is 30 or above.
Got you.
So they are only supposed to be prescribed for obese patients or overweight patients, so BMI 27, plus one obesity-related condition. So you've got diabetes, you've got high cholesterol, you've got sleep apnea, you've got some other related issue. So anyway, so going back to setting point. So my issue or my kind of view of this is that people are then stopping the medication too quickly. Their body doesn't realise that they're now within the healthy range, and much nearer what their genetic settling point should be, and it thinks it needs to get it back up. So people are just putting the weight back on. And of course, what that makes them then feel, I've failed, I'm a bad person. Even on this medication, it didn't work for me. I'm a dreadful, I've done everything wrong, and it compounds all those incredibly negative feelings that often lots of overweight people have already experienced. This kind of self-criticism, the criticism from other people going, why have you put on weight? I thought you were on those medications. You know, all the judgment that comes with it, the self-judgment and the judgment from others. It makes all those things, it brings them back and just, you know.
Gives them a microphone.
Gives it, exactly. Makes it manifestly worse. And so then, of course, what do? Well, they feel really miserable, really upset. They probably start overeating as a way of managing those feelings. Feel even more guilty, even more rubbish. And then they think, well, I've got to go back on that medication. So then they just cycle back on. And it is no different to doing the cabbage soup diet or whatever. So they just cycle on and off, going.
So, but what if they were in the drug the first time for over a year? Is it more likely for them to have long-term success with
it? Yes. So I think, so what we kind of write in the book, what we kind of advocate in the book, is that you see it in three phases. The first phase is the weight loss phase, mm-hmm. where you actively lose weight on the drug, and you titrate the drug up as you're supposed to, up to a dose where you're losing weight, but you do it slowly. So you're only looking at about a kilo roughly a week. So it's slow. And then from there, you then go, right, so I'm going to go, and then once I've reached my kind of goal weight, which there's various ways of working out what that should be, but it should be within the healthy range.
Yeah.
Once I've reached that, I'm going to then move down to what we call a maintenance dose, which is the lowest dose where you get some benefit of the medication, but you still experience hunger, you still experience some of the food noise and so on, but you're given some level of protection from it. And during that phase is when you then, ideally you stay on that for between a year or 18 months. And during that phase, while you're experiencing hunger and so on, but it's protected a bit, or covered a bit by the medication, you then do the psychological work.
And I've seen some people, so they go up, and then they come down rather than stop.
Yes, so that's what what I would advocate. So you go up to the dose where you're treating your obesity.
Yeah.
You're treating, it's a treatment dose. When you then lose the weight that you need to or that you want to, and you're within the healthy range,
you would maintain that set point for a year on it.
You drop down to a dose that's giving you a level of protection. So that's when you do the maintenance, we call maintenance phase. So then you maintain that weight with some of the protection, I would call it protection, but some of the kind of the cover of a low dose, but the dose is low. So you're not actively losing weight anymore, you're maintaining. So you maintain that weight, and that gives your body and your mind time to reacclimatize yourself to that being your new set point. The thing we haven't talked about is that often with people's relationships with food, they have overstimulated the reward pathways of their brain. So they're what we call dysregulated. They're all chaotic. And part of that is to do with dopamine, which is a chemical that's released in the brain that makes us feel happy and rewarded. It's part of the reward pathways. It's a transmitter in the reward pathways. And when you constantly are bombarding it and stimulating your brain, either with anything, with sex, coke, cocaine, shopping, all sorts of these things, you're constantly, it's like a well-worn path, and you get more and more and more. The brain wants you to feel reward, so it kind of makes you overstimulate this part. So you keep on doing it.
The benchmark for dopamine gets higher and higher.
Exactly. Yeah. And you like, that's it. We're like little lab rats pressing a little lever. Yeah. We want more and more of this. So in people who are overweight and obese, they often will show dysregulated reward pathways in their brain. So what being on this for a bit longer and doing it calmly and slowly allows is that reward pathways to be less dysregulated. So they recalibrate, they get back to normal, back to how they should be. So that when you then stop the medication, you're not making decisions around food based on your reward pathways. You're making them about because you're hungry or not and you like the food. And that's something very different. And actually, when patients that we've had who have gone through this program and they come out, they're like, I didn't realize that actually, like a pomegranate and grapefruit and feta cheese salad
could taste
can actually just be nice. I didn't realize that. It was always like, I mustn't eat the Pringles. I mustn't eat the Pringles. I mustn't eat the Pringles. I can't have red velvet cake today because I had some yesterday. Oh, no. Yeah. Oh, now I have had red velvet cake. Oh, now I'm going to eat the whole thing. You know, it's actually quite... It's sort of
freeing.
It's lovely, yeah. But to kind of witness it, it's sort of quite emotional to see people suddenly be freed from this kind of yoke of you know, this being under the tyranny of food, and to know what it's like to just have a fun, healthy, normal relationship with food. It's so lovely seeing it, and I feel that's why I think these drugs can be so incredible, but also are liable to being misused and abused.
How many providers do you think are acting like you, though, percentage-wise?
Well, I think not some. Some are, definitely. I think the ones where you want to, you know, people who are looking for the cheapest deal and they're just getting it prescribed and it's just, you know, ending up...
Yeah.
We all know the people,
the
kind of providers, and it's just being, you know, chucked in a box and good luck to you.
You know there's influencers selling it on social media?
Yeah, which is also illegal because it's a prescription drug.
Okay.
It's illegal.
I did not know that.
It's a prescription-only drug.
People have it in their bios, Max.
No, it's illegal. It's all of these medications, GLP-1s, that's the group, that's what they're called. So Mounjaro and Wegovy and Ozempic and all these things, they're called GLP-1s. They are prescription-only medication. It is illegal to provide them to somebody without a valid prescription.
Next question. We've not spoke about it. No. How do you feel about children? being injected.
Oh, what, they just meant
what
in general.
Is, kids, no, oh, you don't want kids.
Hate them.
No, but how, yeah, I don't like teenagers. But and where do you draw the line there? Because if you're saying from a doctor's point of view, it's a mental illness and I've got a child that, you know, was a similar size to me, if not bigger. We've got 14 stone 11-year-old and whatnot, you know. Where do you draw the line there?
I mean, I would say I don't think obesity is
necessarily... And in the UK, can kids have it? What's the law around that?
They might be doing it. So I'm not sure if it's been licensed yet. That
means
it's been formally approved.
Well,
so that's it. I would say, just to go back on your point, I would say I don't necessarily think being obese is a mental illness. I'd say that I think there's often psychological problems that are fueling it and emotional problems. And I think that's something maybe we're going to talk about later, the difference between a difficulty... an emotional difficulty or psychological problem or difficulty and a mental illness. Because I think sometimes those two are conflated quite a lot, so that we brand everything, every difficulty we ever have, as a mental illness. And I think that's not always helpful.
Well, it's like everyone goes, oh, you know, I've got anxiety. You know, it's terrible, I've got anxiety. It's like, no, you know, and then people go, you know, you've got poor mental health. No, I've just lost my husband. He's had a car.
Exactly,
back.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll get into that. Yeah,
yeah. So I think, so just to sort of clarify, I wouldn't say that obesity is a mental illness as such. It could be for various reasons. But I would say it's more, it's often because of an emotional problem or emotional difficulties or trauma and things like that. My personal feeling, and I'm sure that there's always outliers, so I don't like talking in kind of absolute terms, that, you know, you never know. And there are children, there's like a condition called Prader-Willi syndrome where it's like a hormonal difficulty and they are instead, I've got a feeling Katie Price's kid has it, I think.
Yeah, but it's very, very uncommon.
It is very, exactly. So I wouldn't want to say never. But certainly there are children with often developmental problems where the parts of their brain to do with hunger and with feeling full have got problems, and they have a very, very severe disability because of it. So I wouldn't say, so it may well be
Let's
that these
take the
are useful.
People
yes.
with disabilities
so
out of
to
it.
To kind
then.
Of like remove that, do I think it's a good idea? My personal feeling, controversially, is I think it's not a good idea because, and actually I feel that anyone really... any younger people, probably, even if they are over the age of 18, shouldn't necessarily be having access to these drugs. I feel that they should be once you've tried everything else. And my, again, part of my concern is I think people are just immediately going, oh, there's a cure for this now. I need to lose weight. Even the people who are genuinely overweight, oh, I'll just do this then. And they've never tried to make changes themselves. And I think that's not helpful. I feel we're... the brilliant thing about being human, but also the scary thing, is that we've got the capacity for incredible amounts of change and we can take responsibility for our lives. And I think, so all my patients, I'm always a bang on about taking responsibility, because I think that is the most extraordinary, amazing thing, that we are responsible for our lives, but it's also the most petrifying thing for people. It's incredibly scary. Because it means you can take all the rewards when things go well, but equally you have to take responsibility when things don't go so well. And I think it's very difficult, but actually, if we don't take responsibility, I think we're not living our lives to the fullest. And I think it's quite a bleak, anemic version of our lives. So I feel that by giving children these, we aren't helping them develop alternative coping strategies to change their behaviour, to change their view of the world, and also to show them you've actually got more control than you think you do. And that's my concern. It's like, you know, you feel out of control with food, so we're going to give you a medication that takes away that out feeling out of control, that essentially still is, you're still not in control because you're taking medication. And I think for a child, we have to be very careful when we start communicating that you don't have control of your life or aspects of your life. I think that's part of the problem of modern society. And we should actually be moving the other way and should be encouraging children, you do have control. Look what you can change. Look what you can do when you put your mind to it. And I think that it would be a tragedy if we started getting all the children that are overweight or struggling with their weight, rather than saying, you have capacity to change your world and your life, we say, you don't have capacity to change your world or to change your life, to do anything about your body or relationship with food. So instead, we're going to give you a medication that essentially also takes away that control for you. That, to me, sends a very, very profound, quite chilling message to children. So I would be very cautious in advising the children. As we say, the caveat is there's bound to be other people on the outskirts, the outliers.
Also says to children, like, you're not enough. Do you not, in a subconscious way? And interesting, you were talking about, you know, we're I feel that we are constantly outsourcing responsibility. I feel like ChatGPT is ruining our ability for creativity, for independent thinking.
I feel like you're my
thinking.
Spirit animal. Oh, I feel like I've never
met
you before.
Max, as you were talking, I was like, he has to come round for dinner. Because no one else listens to me and my mates think I'm
this,
crazy.
I'm exactly the same. I bang on about this. I write about it nearly every week in my column. I'm always doing stuff. And I feel like I'm just shouting into the void. Yeah. But also, I do think that maybe we're the silent majority. And I think a lot more people do agree with us. Because inherently, it feels right. I think you don't have to know all the words or the experience. It just feels right. Let's allow people to be responsible.
We want what's easy, and I feel like we've been conditioned to do. We want to mass produce. We want to create a higher yield. We want to act efficiently. And these things, these tools that we believe are allowing us the ability to, and that for me, they lose the ability and the illusion of time as well, which is like, we'll get into that, but. We are outsourcing so much of our power that we're almost raising a generation also of like cyborgs that are being told how to think. We are told how to think, how to. If you want to be a good person, you know who you should vote for, yeah? Like, if you want to be seen on the right side of the march, you know where you should go. Where we don't, we've got this very much black and white.
Yes.
Which doesn't allow space for colour.
Exactly. And the bit in between. And the reality is the world is not black and white. Mm. It takes us a bit back to our food. Like,
yeah.
It's sometimes helpful to feel like things are black and white, but actually it's not true. It's an illusion. And it's an illusion that we develop. I mean, it's what we call cognitive distortion within psychology. It's a way of viewing the world that's not really true. It's convenient. And black and white thinking is one of the cognitive distortions. It's an unhelpful thinking strategy that people employ all the time. To some extent, it can be helpful because the world is chaos and mad and there's no order and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And if we can just put, even if it's an artificial categories of black and white, it helps us feel more in control. Mm. But the reality is that can also be incredibly unhelpful because it is artificial. And I feel like this is one of the things that has happened is that everything has been polarised. You're either right or you're wrong. You're this person or you're that person.
Left wing or right wing.
Yeah, you're this or you're that. And everything. And actually, it's kind of sad. And I feel it diminishes our experience of the world. And it means also everyone becomes increasingly in their own little kind of factions. And you can't ever mix with anybody else. Because again, that introduces chaos. Because somebody in the white bit can't have an argument with somebody over in the black bit there. Because that's crazy. You know, so if you're left, you can't have friends who are right wing. Because then it would be introducing chaos again. And I feel that's really sad. Like one of my dearest, closest friends, who I absolutely adored, and she died 3 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And she was also in her late 90s. So, and she was a nun. And long story short, when I went to school, I went to a very unusual school. I went to a convent.
Okay.
That had just started allowing boys in. And I went, you know, I was, and it was in the middle of Slough. It was very rough, kind of lots of deprivation around. And there was this school there that was run by nuns. And it was this like oasis. And I came from, you know, rough working class family. My dad was a milkman. And I went to this school and it was just like the scales fell from my eyes. It was the most extraordinary experience. And I felt every day so lucky to go there because there was all these people that sort of really cared about you and were so sort of thoughtful. It felt like it was this oasis in the kind of, you know, this in the Slough of Slough, I mean, this kind of, you know, the bog of Slough. It was this just an incredible oasis where people were sort of cerebral and thoughtful and so on. And I loved it. And she was the headmistress. It was Sister Mae Stevens, and she was the headmistress. And I decided to do for A-level, I did biblical scripture. I'm an atheist, and she knew that.
You're still an atheist?
Yeah, absolutely. Just crashing it. So, but I was like, you know, this woman has dedicated her life to this one book. So, I mean, what an incredible experience to be taught about this one book from somebody dedicated their entire life, given up, sacrificed their whole life for this. So I became incredibly close. There was only a few of us did it. It's quite a weird A-level, and they've even stopped it now. So I know, I loved it. It was odd. I mean, what I don't know about John, you know, the fourth gospel, I know everything about it. And Samuel 1 and 2, like we did in real loads in depth. And I loved it. And I was taught by this woman. She was so inspirational and extraordinary. She knew I was gay and she knew I was an atheist.
When did you realise you were gay?
Oh, when I was like very little.
But in during your experience in the convent school?
Yeah, oh God, yes, absolutely. I mean, I didn't tell her until I'd left school, but I did. But
she could sense it.
But yeah, but you know, but we were maintained friends. So when I left school, we'd had this kind of quite intimate relationship. It was strange, you know. There was like four of us doing the A-level, so you know it was
intimate.
It was intimate, and also I was head boy as well, so I knew her even better through that.
Yeah.
So we kind of had this very close relationship with her, and she didn't agree with me. I didn't agree with her. We were polar opposites in many, many ways. She was, like, at that point, her 80s. You know, I was a teenager. We have very little in common on paper. And yet this woman, I feel, transformed my life in many ways. She gave me an insight into extraordinary, just into another world. And she used to give me books to read, and I give her books to read. I mean, like, really, she used to give me, like, really complicated theological books. And I did a degree, as well as medical school, I did a degree in anthropology. And so I give her loads of anthropology books about, like, the anthropology of religion and stuff. And we had we disagreed, and we fundamentally disagreed, and we agreed to disagree, but we also found points of connection. And the thing I feel really sad about society now is I feel like relationships like that are almost kind of banned.
Well, this is what this show is.
And this is really sad, because I think Sister Mae Stephen enriched my life. It truly enriched it. And actually, I went to her, she had a party just before COVID. It was a closed order as well, so they weren't allowed to leave the convent. It was hardcore. No, they had to write to Reverend Mother, who's based in France. There was convents all around the world.
Well, she couldn't come up to the shops or anything.
No, they weren't allowed to own possessions. So they had every evening they had a wristwatch, and they would have to take the wristwatch off. And there was a bowl in the central lobby, and they'd have to put the wristwatch in the bowl. And every morning they would put their hand in the bowl and pick up another wristwatch, because they couldn't own any possessions. I mean, it was extraordinary. You know, it was an interesting thing.
I would love to go stay with them.
They were wonderful. You can go and stay with them. They're really lovely. But I mean, unfortunately now, when I was there, there was a lot of them. And this was years ago. And now they've very much dwindled.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But they're still fantastic. They run a retreat now. They've moved from Slough, and they're now up in Gloucestershire. And they run a retreat for people to go to. Anyway. So, I mean, she had this... It was just an insight into this extraordinary life. And I just feel, you know, despite this, coming from such different backgrounds, such different worldviews, we had this connection. And people, again and again, don't have that now. It feels like it's banned. And I kind of feel that we are having a diminished experience of our worlds, because there are people you can't talk to or shouldn't talk to or associate with or be friends with. And when I went to her... she'd been a nun for 60 years, I think it was, and she had like a celebration for it. So I went, and it was really, there was a whole load of other nuns there, as you might expect, and lots of other people. And it was actually incredibly touching, because she saw me in the audience. I mean, she invited me. She saw me in the audience when she stood up to say thank you. And she said, oh, I can see Max is here. And she told this story about when, because we had to go for an interview at the school. It was a state school, but we had to go for an interview. And she said, like, I remember when I interviewed him when he was 11 years old, and this, and she was told, and she, you know, and he's become such a dear friend. And I stood there thinking, and people, it was quite embarrassing, because, you know, I didn't quite well up, but also I went bright red, because it was embarrassing, because it was like a room of 100 people, and they were looking at me. And
I was like,
this actually isn't about me. Thank you, but it's not about me. But I was like, how strange. And I understood why, because she was talking about the impact that the children she taught had on her life, so on and so on. And I just happened to be there in her eye line. But I was like, how amazing that actually I feel you've given me so much, but clearly that is reciprocated.
Yeah.
You know, that you're standing up on your kind of special day and you're mentioning me. So we had this kind of reciprocity, this sharing. And I just think how sad that people now can't have that. And is that not also the reason for lots of conflict in the world? Mm.
The world's because, so divisive.
Because I'm not Catholic. I think the Catholic Church are not great, but I would defend nuns with my dying breath.
Yeah.
And I think, because once you know somebody, it changes your understanding. It's very easy to other people.
But what we do is we put labels on opposing parties that almost stops us from having conversations.
Yeah, we other them. Them like they're all over there. And, you know, and this is what I kind of think is incredibly sad about the world.
And this is what this show has always been about. And it's been about speaking to people. And at times it's come at a cost for me because of the type of people I have spoken to. But for me, we're all driving to this finish line, Max, getting there. And I don't know if you know about the Hoffman process, but...
is that the breathing?
Not Wim Hof. No, that's a different one. But you go and stay in the house for 8 days, no watch, no clock, no telephone, 24 strangers. The homework's like 62 pages.
God.
Yeah. And basically, it's essentially meant to be like 10 years worth of therapy in 8 days. And it goes back into all your childhood and your programming. And it's a lot, yeah? Even for me, it's a lot. And I... But in those rooms, before in those rooms, I came to realize that we're not all going to the same finish line, and everyone's island of success is totally different. And that's where the show was born, because at one point I was so conditioned, especially working in the corporate world, you know, of thinking that everyone wants the same things. We're all heading to the same destination. And we live in a world where we're really quick to judge everyone's finish line. Why are you heading there? Why the fuck would he want that? Rather than sitting down and understanding the driving factors of why someone's chosen to go somewhere. And for me, it's always been at the heart of the conversations, because we are living in a world, like you say, so polarizing, so scary, that we're not allowing this diversity in between. Like, if you lined up my friends, Max, you wouldn't pick them in a lineup. Like, they're so totally different. And like, I don't want to say like the in-betweeners, because, but like, literally, you wouldn't put us all together. I've got so many different friends that bring so much to my life, for all different age groups, that, you know, I grew up in Essex, you can probably tell, but, and the group of girlfriends I had are all very the same. There's a group chat with them. I've never been in a group chat. 14 people, blah, blah, blah. And they have the same, and this isn't judgment, but they have the same outlooks on life. Yeah. They're doing the same things. They live. But for me, I've always been like so curious about what is going on in the world and what's driving people. And I think we have so much more in common than what people think.
Yes. I mean, that's what I, to be honest, that's one of the things I quite like about being gay, is that I remember, this is the honest to God truth, I remember we were having a dinner party and there was an asylum seeker there who's one of my dearest friends called Matt. He's like, I feel like he's like my brother. He's actually now not, he's now got, had his asylum has been granted. He's now a British citizen. Just been, it was honestly really good. I was so happy for him. Anyway, but at the time he was an asylum seeker going through that process. He'd been rejected 3 times. It was all very traumatic and awful for him. And he was sitting next to the son of a Russian oligarch at our dinner.
Yeah.
They were having, and I love, and I was sitting there just thinking, and they've got on really well. They're still friends now. And I love, and I was sitting there thinking, I don't know, like, in a way, because, you know, being gay, kind of, you're joined up by your sexuality rather than your background or your education or the colour of your skin or anything else. It's like there's another overarching kind of thing that connects you. And I was thinking, and I was looking around this table and I was like, there's such a random mix of people here. And I thought, isn't it sad that actually other people don't get to experience this so much? And actually, I think particularly my straight friends, their friendship groups tend to be quite homogenous. It's like, oh, we know them from ballet class where we take our kids, and we know this and this is this, you know, and like, oh, I work with this person. And actually, one of the things I think I really sort of value about being gay is that I feel that because you've got that in common, you end up mixing and meeting really diverse and interesting groups of people in a way that maybe other people don't. But I just feel kind of with social media now, increasingly, I think even that's changing with social media. I think the younger generation, there's so many factions. So that, you know, I think your average kind of 18, 19, 20 year old, even if they're gay, for example, don't necessarily have a diverse group of friends particularly.
No, because you'll probably only see what you search, and then you get fed more of it.
So this is my concern. And also, rage is what makes people click.
Yeah, rage is like 10 times more.
So they're never going to be like, oh, that's cheered me up. Oh, good. It's all, the underlying emotion, and we know this from all the psychological studies, and it makes me profoundly worried that there's all these companies employ vast amounts of psychologists. You know, they are weaponizing our brains against us. They know that rage is what is going to drive engagement. And I'm like, so why are we allowing kids, ourselves even, to have something that's going to enrage us? Rage is never produced, or very rarely produced, anything good in humanity. Like, we do not need rage.
Yeah, we don't. And I also feel that, I know we touched on it earlier, but time has really, I know everyone's like, time doesn't really exist, but for young children and people, like, I feel like I'm old enough and ugly enough to know that half the shit that I see online isn't real. But I'm probably at the bottom end of that spectrum.
Yeah.
I turn 35 in December. I think anyone just coming up to 30 might know that, you know, what people's posting is not real.
But I would just say, just going back to eating disorder thing, because this was a serious issue in, what you're saying is, it was a serious, serious issue we had to confront the eating disorder service.
Yeah.
Because, and I've written about this subsequently, we had a number of influencers who had very, very serious eating disorders, and they were followed by vast amounts of people, and they were kind of posting food they were eating, you know, their meals for that day and so on and so on. And What they weren't posting was the four Sara Lee Gatto cakes that were binging on and then puking up in the toilets.
Mm.
And we were like, actually, this is a serious issue because we've got a group of people that are portraying one thing on the media. Now, they had cooked the food and they were probably going to eat it. But what they, it was such a select, narrow thing that they were presenting. They weren't giving the context. And people were looking at them thinking, you know, well, you look amazing and you eat all this food and so on. And actually, we were like, do we have a public health duty? Like, is there a duty as the doctors to intervene and tell people and say, this person actually has an eating disorder? And we were like, of course we can't because of patient confidentiality. We were like, but actually, these people are unwell. And nobody
giving
has
advice.
And nobody has an idea, exactly. And we were like, this actually is... We had like a lot of internal discussions around what to do about these influencers who were in our service and that we knew were very unwell. And were giving advice to people and posting stuff online that people were consuming.
But this is what I'm saying. Anyway. Like, most influencers I know are on weight loss drugs.
Yeah.
But going back to what I was saying, I feel like we are losing the illusion of time. Not only the time that young people spend on devices, like the average 13, 14-year-old, 15, 16-year-old will spend more time on their phone than they will in the real world. Like, they're doing like 8-hour-a-day shifts on a device.
Yeah.
So you have just, you know how we just said about the women who, if we could put their time and energy instead of food into the real world,
yeah,
we are raising a generation of cyborgs that cannot look you in the eye. But this is my concern, and I watched it with my 4-year-old. It's like an Amazon culture. He's like, Mum, has that football come? It's like, no, it's going to come next day, which is still super quick, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But we have no idea of what it takes to get somewhere. And I feel like as a generation, we are losing grit and resilience and time. So what's happening is something uncomfortable happens and we think life's not meant to look like that. So we just give in or we give up because we're seeing this perfectly curated Instagram reel on how our lives should look. And we have got a generation of pussies. But you've got no real concept of time, resilient and grit.
Yeah.
And you know, I went to bed last night thinking about this interview today and something popped into my head. Do you know, obviously you do, you know the cigarettes and then they eventually put the warning on the back.
Yeah.
I wonder what it would be like if we had a warning on social media. A warning, if you log in, you're likely to lose the next hour of your day, feel less good about yourself and less likely to look your friend in the eye.
I've written literally this. I'm like, if I created a product and said, I've got this product, everyone's going to love it. In fact, you're actually going to get addicted to it. And by the way, you're going to increase your risk of anxiety, depression, suicidal thoughts. You may get groomed through it and sexually, your children might be sexually abused.
Consent.
Is that a good idea? Everyone will go, are you mad? That should be banned. That sounds awful. That's literally what we've just allowed to happen.
Yeah.
I don't understand. And now we're all questioning, you know, we're like, oh, please, Facebook, please, could you put some restrictions? I'm like, this is bonkers. If I created it as a product and sold it, there would be an outcry. You would never even get to the stage where I could release it. So, you know, if it was a tablet and I said, this is going to increase your risk of suicidal thoughts, of eating disorders, of self-harm, would never be allowed to be released. It wouldn't even get to the stage. You know, you wouldn't even... And yet that's exactly what social media has done. That is exactly social media. So I do not understand how we've got to the stage where it is even debated that people under the age of 16 should be able to access it. I don't even understand how we've got to that stage. No 18-year-old, no one under the age of 18 needs a mobile phone, full stop. Do you know, I grew up in a time without a mobile phone, and once or twice I locked myself out and I worked out how to break in through the bathroom window. Really useful.
Life skills, babe.
Or you just sit on the step.
You won't do that again, will you?
Exactly. And people say, "Oh, yeah, but what if you know? But you know, what if they're picked up by sexual predators?" Don't worry, they're online. They're getting picked up there by sexual predators. I'm like, a paedophile isn't bother going around anymore. Driving around the streets trying to pick up kids that've locked themselves out because they just log on and they'll find them on Snapchat. So I'm like, this doesn't make sense. I think our thinking about it is so warped, and I think we've been sucked into it. I feel very, very strongly about social media. When I worked in CAMHS in children, adolescent, mental health services, and in eating disorders, where I saw a lot of younger people, I used to just have my head in my hands, just thinking, I feel so lucky to be born when I just missed all this. This just was not a thing for me, and I'm very pleased that at some point I sort of resisted the temptation.
Can we talk about that? Made an active decision.
Well, I did.
Not to be on social media.
Yes.
Did you know?
Okay. I mean, I'm on Twitter, although I don't look at it and I don't have it on my phone. And that's only because my agent set me up on it. And I feel I don't engage with it, so I don't bother. Where it comes from, this is, so we were talking about me living in Old Street in the 90s. So I lived in Old Street in the 90s. And my best friend at medical school is still a very dear friend I saw at the weekend. She is quite maverick. She is from a traveller family. She hadn't been to school until she was 16. And she is truly, people say the word genius and it's overused. She's truly a genius. She went to school at the age of 16. I'll tell you very quickly a story about her.
Go on.
So she was in Middlesbrough. And she got put in a comprehensive. Now, she'd never been to school. And the first day, it was her math class. And she was kind of streamed in like the middle class because they just put her in. It's massive comprehensive. And the teacher, you know, no proper introduction or anything. Teacher was on the board and said, right, I want to draw an appropriate table for all these numbers that are on the board. And so Sarah, that's my friend, sat there thinking, this is a bit of a weird. I thought this was maths. So she drew a table with four legs.
Yeah.
And the teacher went over, thought she was some kind of special needs person and put her in the bottom group. And so she was streamed bottom.
Okay.
So she was sitting there thinking, well, this is easy. Anyway, 2 years later, she'd never had a television because it's a traveller community. She'd never seen a television. She'd never seen Wimbledon, never had anything to do with tennis. But with all the naughty kids in the bottom group, they used to bunk off all the time. So she was bunking off and she started watching Wimbledon. And she sat there and she'd never played tennis, but she was like, oh, it's all angles. It's all maths. Yeah. But within 2 years, she was a professional tennis player, having never picked up a racket. So she made quite a lot of money. She was on tours, making quite a lot of money. And then halfway through, she thought, actually, I don't really want this as a life. She said it was quite tiring. So she went and came to medical school. So she was slightly older than all of us lot, but just brilliant. And she was mad and maverick and knew everything. And, you know, was this slightly older and this being this professional tennis player. So I immediately gravitated towards her and I loved her and thought she was brilliant. And she said, well, let's move in together. But there's one condition. I don't have television because I've never had a television. I don't like them. I think it's bad. So you have to, if you move in with me, television's a band. And actually, when I was a kid, we'd had a television and it was like on hire purchase and it'd been taken away for a bit. So I'd actually got used to not having a television. It'd been like not repossessed. I can't think of the word, you know, like taken back.
Yeah.
So I kind of had a period where I'd not had a television. And I thought, do you know what? Yeah, because I kind of know myself and I just ended up watching TV all day.
And you're how old for context?
46.
No, so, then, when this was going?
18, 19.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, yeah, we'll try it. And I love that. So we lived in this madhouse, there's a whole group of us, no TV. We used to just sit around this big table smoking. That's all we did all day.
And conversate.
Yeah, and reading The Guardian to each other and stuff like that. And I loved it. And then when I then got older and I got my own place, I thought, I'm not going to suddenly have a television. I like it. It's kind of a bit maverick not having a TV. And I kind of felt very similar to social media. I thought everyone's doing it. And I just got this inherent slight mistrust of crowds and groups and the way that people think. Because I think people often then don't think when they're in a group. And I remember when the social media was sort of starting to be a thing. And I thought, I just don't like the idea that people know a lot about me, that I'm posting things. And it was very much down to Sarah, and she's now she's a paediatric surgeon at Great Ormond Street. She's got four kids, and I remember about 2 years ago, I was saying to her, I was talking about social media and what a nightmare it was, similar to this. And she said, oh, I know, it's difficult. She said, you know, I've relented now, and they're allowed an hour. So four kids, she's like, they're allowed an hour. And I was like, I mean, that's pretty good, you know, an hour, because they only have one iPad. And she was like, so allowed an hour on it. I said, it's not bad, you know, an hour a day for four, you know, it's okay. And she went, no, they're allowed an hour a week and it's all four of them. They've got to work out they have to do it. I was like, what?
Surely like, they're just like cracking each other over the head with it. Like, my turn.
Yeah. And she was like, so then it's teaching them. They have to wait because Hugh is getting 15 minutes. Then Tom is getting 15 minutes. And so, and I was like, this is unheard of. Whereas you've got other parents going like, you know, well, it's basically they're using it as surrogate, as kind of proxy childminders.
Is this another parent? It's another parent in people's
lives.
Yeah,
I've got it's a childminder.
That propped their children up with it from them.
Yeah.
And this is not from a space of judgment. This
I can understand. It's a nightmare.
So I have, as a rule of thumb, Henry doesn't have an iPad. But when we go away, but it's interesting. I even catch myself like on an aeroplane, he's allowed it. If we go to an adult dinner, he's allowed it. Not if there's other children. Because I also think, like, what four-year-old actually is like, if me and my partner are there, like, mate, you're not up to speed. Like,
yeah,
he'll do colouring for so long. Like, obviously, we wing out the colouring and then he can have it. But it was interesting. Our friends, give their, they're still very aware, but give their children the devices a lot more. And we were away with them at fireworks night. So I also don't want to be like, you can't, they have a little device that Henry was peering on it. And they were like, you know, we don't want them getting bored. And I said, but what did we do when we were bored?
I'm obsessed with boredom.
Boredom creates space for creativity.
Boredom is, I think that's the one thing we should be teaching children, is how to be bored. Like, do you remember, like, so back in the day, in the 80s and 90s, Sunday afternoons.
Yeah.
I can almost taste the boredom now thinking about it. Mind-numbingly boring. Nothing on television, nothing to do, raining outside, sitting there just going, what are we doing? When's tea, Mum? Shut up! So boring. But actually, that is what... Now, we can't tolerate anything that's longer than 5 seconds. I think what's really interesting, if you watch a black and white film, it's so slow... So agonising. Now, 50 years ago, black and white films, people used to dedicate their entire Saturday afternoons to it. They loved it. You know, these were like so exciting. They're, you know, now, so boring. You couldn't get a 10-year-old to sit down and watch a black and white film. They're just the shots. Literally, the scenes are too long to keep the attention. And you watch now TV, and if you click your fingers every time there's a scene change, it's literally, you'll be like, or a camera angle change, it's boom, 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 because we need constant stimulation. And you watch people flicking through Instagram or TikTok or whatever. It's just, I'm like, you could not have taken that on board. You could not have read it. And actually, we just want constant bombardment, constant stimulation, constant information. We need to be constantly on. And then we wonder why our children have problems with sleeping, anxiety, ADHD, all sorts of other things. Of course they're going to, because they're constantly being stimulated. Teaching your children to be bored is one of the best life skills you can ever do.
Because I feel like through boredom comes creativity.
Yeah.
And I believe a lot of the gifts that we have already live within us, and absolutely, it's about unlocking it.
Yeah. But if you're constantly being bombarded with stuff, you're not sitting, there's no kind of moment of introspection, of thought, of like going through, well, because actually what did we used to do on a Sunday? I mean, we used to stay out the window quite a lot looking at the rain, but actually we used to kind of do puzzles, and my sister used to do some painting, and I did pottery, and you know, you just kind of make things up, or you play or do stuff. Like, how important is that? I used to write stories, and then I became a writer. You know,
you wouldn't have found that if you were sat in front of a television.
Exactly. And actually, you're sitting there on a Sunday evening, bored out your brains, writing a story just to entertain yourself. I mean, that's done me really well. It's bought my flat.
Yeah, of course.
So thank you very much.
But also, like, gone were the days, you know, when children, you would give them a rolling pin and a mixing bowl, and they would play. But even when it comes to the stimulation of children's toys, it's the colours, it's the shapes, it's the noise, it's all of it. And just touching on what you were saying there about the black and white films, most songs that are classic hits, would not be classic hits now, because they have like a 40-second interlude.
Yeah.
We would be like, turn this over, it's boring. Yes. Or it's not like, boom,
because you just
boom.
Switch off on Spotify, you just scanned over. It's like, no, it needs to grab me instantaneously or I'm moving on to the next one.
So what do you think ChatGPT is doing? ChatGPT particularly, because I feel like people are using it to write their emails now.
Well, I think it's sad. And I don't really, I'm kind of intrigued. I don't think anybody really knows the answer. That's it. I mean, it's a brilliant question, but I think if we knew it,
But there's part of your brain that's shutting off, that's not being used.
Yes. And part of me feels it's going to happen. And it feels a bit like everybody, you know, 100 years ago, all the gas lamp lighters around London going like, oh, electricity, what could happen? You know, it's like it was, you know, they were always going to be out of a job. It was always going to be electrified, you know, street lights at some point. It was just going to happen. It's pointless trying to fight against it. So part of me thinks it's just inevitable. So it's pointless. We have to just embrace AI because it's here and we're not going to get rid of it. But the other part of me does think, I think it's going to fundamentally change society. It's going to be another industrial revolution kind of shift.
100%.
Because suddenly, even down to how we examine people. Because actually, if you can put into ChatGPT and you do your essays. So actually, one of the people I work with in my hospital, there's like an associate person, they're called, they're like an assistant, and he's training to be a social worker, and he was saying they basically stopped giving us essays because there's no point, because everybody's just doing
on
ChatGPT, and it's like, and he was saying it's like ours is the first year where they've just basically said there's no point in giving you essays, and I'm like, wow, okay, so in which case everything, like, it's going to fundamentally affect so much, like, even how we test people in education.
Has that not gone back to we're stopping ourselves from doing the hard stuff? I never went to university, but I had to do A levels and the essays and that.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, especially for someone who's got raging ADHD, like, so painful. But also, I don't know if we're going to have to do another episode because I've got to see if they've got kicked out here. Because I actually wanted one of the things I wanted to talk to was ADHD and this overdiagnosis and the labels, but also.
Well, I'm making a documentary about it for Channel 4. I'm doing a documentary on it for Channel 4, so I can always come back and talk about that.
Okay, we'll have to do
I'm
that.
I'm filming it next month.
But then, like, we're excusing bad behaviour also. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, if I was given, listen, and I was a child who had an alcoholic parent who lived in a really traumatic house that was super volatile, that I was always on edge, and as a result, I had chronic ADHD. I mean, Max, you know, you're talking about the naughty kids. I had to sit with my hands in the class. There were four of us in the class. I weren't allowed to touch a buzzer burner. I weren't allowed to touch the javelin. Because I'd just be like, oh, hey. Like, and I literally accidentally nearly killed someone with it just without not thinking. Like, I just would like throw scissors by accident. Just genuinely not thinking. But if I was given that red card, which I would 100% be given now, and I had access to ChatGPT, let me tell you now, I'm not sitting in the class. I'm overstimulated and I'm not going to go and do the essays. And I think hard stuff comes when we do the stuff that we don't want to do.
Absolutely.
The uncomfortable stuff. And it's really easy going like, everyone's got ADHD, blah, blah, blah. But also attention is a skill. And I've had to in those times. And I also wonder how much worse my ADHD would have been if I'd had short form content going at home on my own, no parent. I would have done that to self-regulate.
Absolutely, yeah.
But attention is a skill, and for children, it worries me that they have none, and those moments for introspection. And it's only in the moments of introspection that we can decide where our finish line is, rather than what we think it should be.
Yes.
And I don't know, I just feel like we're raising a group of cyborgs, and it scares me. Do you have kids?
No.
We don't like them. We went in there, didn't we?
I feel all the wonderful things that have ever happened to me have been because I've done something that was quite hard and difficult and I didn't really want to do at the time. And I sat there thinking, why the hell did I say yes to this? You know, and actually they've always produced rather things like writing a book is quite horrible. I'm not going to, you know, I don't particularly like writing. I do writing every day. I'm not a natural writer. I don't yearn to write. If I didn't have a deadline, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah.
It can be quite painful, writing, the process of writing. But I tell you, there is nothing as amazing as happened to me once walking down Charing Cross Road, and I looked left. I was actually on the phone to my gran. I looked left and there was a display of my books. It is like, honestly, it's like there is not a drug in the world that can replicate that feeling. I've got photographs of it on my phone. I was just standing there, just aghast going, and they'd done a whole little display. And I was just like, I wrote that. I literally, people walking past, I was going, it's me, I wrote that.
Or like, do you want a picture?
Or being on the tube, or people coming up to you, or you go do a book reading, and people come up to you and go like, thank you so much for writing this, I've really enjoyed it. Or like, you know, I was having a difficult time, and I sat down and you really cheered me up. And you think, or like, you know, you've articulated something I've been thinking, and I'm so pleased because I don't feel so alone. I know that somebody else also thinks the same, you know, whatever it might be. And I sit there thinking, oh, that is brilliant. How exciting. I put something out into the world. But God, it was horrible. And if I could have pressed the button saying you don't have to do this, I definitely would have pressed it. I mean, only because I commit to it. But that's, you know, that's just with writing. But that's like things with lots of things in life. It's only the things that are worth doing are often really quite unpleasant and horrible, at least at the beginning. You know, nobody becomes an Olympic javelin thrower or swimmer without a load of absolute horrific agony leading up to it. Then they win their gold at the Olympics, fantastic. But my God, they put in tens of thousands of hours beforehand of practice, of driving, going at 4 a.m, going off to the swimming pool or the ice rink or whatever it is. Like, how awful, but it was worth it for that moment.
And I wonder if you would have felt such reward had you got ChatGPT to write.
Exactly.
Well, you would have felt nothing.
Exactly. So I kind of, I feel like, you know, and you look at everything. You look at, you go to see the Sistine Chapel. I just came back from Rome. You see the Sistine Chapel, extraordinarily beautiful. I bet that was a real bitch to paint.
Yeah.
Like, nobody's sitting there going, oh, good, I'm doing this. Yeah. They're going, oh my God, you've got paint in my eye. This is a nightmare. You know, their arms are hurt. Like, when you think of all the beautiful things in the world that have been created, most of them have been really, really hard to do. And they've required real dedication, real, like, fortitude and strength. And I kind of feel how sad that we are potentially bringing up a generation who will not experience that kind of glory and excitement in the world.
And I feel like we're living where we don't want to do uncomfortable things because we've got a state if we don't have to. Whereas years ago, like if you wanted to get water, which is about you had to go and get the water to survive.
Yes.
Whereas now we're kind of living in this cotton wool and in this cyborg kind of illusion. But I wanted to talk to you, but we're going to have to come back. Okay, we have to come back. We have to do a part two on ADHD.
Okay.
Your book on addiction, because as a child of an addict, I wanted to know, does it hurt? Was your book called?
Oh, so long ago.
Yeah. But I wanted to talk to you about that and
hurt?
Addiction.
Yes. Yes.
And
well, that was from, I worked for a year in addiction services and with homeless people in an outreach project in King's Cross. And I wrote, it's a story about what happened
year.
But yeah.
I want to get into that. I want to get into the ADHD stuff. But for now, Max Pemberton, we spoke about it earlier. Everyone is heading towards some finish line. And where is there to you? Where's yours?
I to be honest, that's a really good question. I feel I don't know where I'm heading and I'm not that bothered. Because what I'm really enjoying, and this is being genuine, I'm not being tacky here. This is not like an Instagram meme. It feels like it is.
This wasn't pre-prepared.
I think it's coming out of my mouth. It feels like it's going to be an Instagram meme. I actually just really like the process of getting wherever I'm going. To be honest, I feel my life is just brilliant. I love it. I feel so incredibly rewarded. I love my job in the NHS. I work full-time in the NHS still and I love it. I enjoy, as I said, I don't necessarily enjoy the process of writing, but I enjoy the privilege of being able to give people my thoughts and to be able to put on a platform for on a national newspaper and in books and so on, what my ideas are and my sort of, you know, what's been going on and kind of interesting me. I've got a great group of friends. I've got a wonderful flat. I just feel really...
So how do you want to be remembered?
I don't care.
No, that's nice. Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to be remembered by the people that knew me very warmly.
Yeah.
But I'm not looking... I feel like that is down that path misery lies when you try and think of any some kind of long-term legacy.
Because it comes attached to ego, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And also, the truth is when you're dead.
And also there's a very famous poem, Ozymandias by Percy Blythe Shelley. And it's about a traveller. And it starts off with saying this traveller and he's kind of travelling in this foreign land and he sees all this sand. And there's, you know, this kind of desert and he sees this this wreck, this kind of, you know, ruined city. And that there is this king and it sort of says that there's, you know, there's a half face of this king, this massive statue. And it's been wrecked and it's all kind of, you know, the desert's taken over. And there's a thing saying like along the lines of like, look at all this and fear, you know, I'm so great. And he says he looks and there's this ruined city. And I feel like that sort of the narcissism of thinking I'm going to have some kind of legacy is guaranteed to be futile. Mm. Like it will, like wherever you build will collapse at some point because everything does. So it's pointless trying to build anything too grand in the world, you know, by which I mean your kind of legacy and being too narcissistic about it, because in 100 years time, no one will remember and no one will care.
Mm.
You know, and I think of all the amazing novelists from Victorian times that nobody's even heard of now.
Yeah.
You know, who were really popular at the time. I kind of feel that way madness lies. Much better to just live in the moment. And
when's the book coming out? What's it called?
So it's called The Weight Loss Prescription and it's out on the 26th of February.
Oh, amazing. And the ADHD program?
That
we
haven't started
that?
Filming it yet.
Okay, we can't. We're gonna come back and talk about it.
I don't know when it's coming out, but we're filming it next month. Well, it starts next week. Actually, we're filming for a couple of months during January and February. So I'd imagine it'll be probably about in the summer. But do get Courtney to come back. So Courtney, I co-wrote the book with Courtney. She's wonderful. You would love her. She'd love you.
Okay, amazing. Right. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It's been a genuine absolute pleasure.